All right, let's get started. As you obviously figured out, there was a little bit of a confusion last week with the jumping to the Beis Yosef. Obviously, we got a little bit out of chronological order, but going back to the original plan, we are up to the Ramban. So let me start off by making some very brief but necessary introductions. First of all, in a half an hour or less, this clearly won't be exhaustive. The related point is, I want to be very clear that I have no interest and no intent on being inactive or objective reporter or historian. I'm not speaking about this from a distant perspective or from an objective perspective. I want to share with you facts, but I want to be very upfront in my bias, if that's the right word, that I'm coming to you out of overwhelming reverence and awe for the sheer awesomeness of the Ramban. And we have to understand what we're dealing with. It's just mind-blowing. I cannot possibly, probably, ilo pilo mani shir skayam. If I had all the time and all the words in the vocabulary, I don't think I could possibly really convey the greatness of the Ramban, but certainly not in the limited time that we have. But you have to understand we're dealing with someone who is just beyond anything that we could really perhaps comprehend, but we have to try so that we can have an appropriate understanding and reverence and awe for his invaluable place in the Mesorah. So what I thought I would do in the brief time that we have is try to divide up the presentation into two distinct halves. I'm not sure if they'll work out chronologically as 50-50, but two parts of the presentation. The first will be to give a very brief overview of his biography, just the key dates and occurrences and events in his life. And then the second part, would be even harder to do in a short period of time, is to give you some sense of his literary, Torah, scholarly output. Part of what makes the Ramban so unique, so awesome, is just the sheer volume and variety of his Torah scholarship, but we'll get to that in a little bit. His life is also quite incredible and quite impressive. So to begin in the beginning, as far as we know, the Ramban was born at the end of the 12th century at 1194 in Spain in the city of Gerona. He was, I assume eventually you would have to say he's the most famous member of his family, but he was not born into some anonymous simple family. He was actually born into a family that was very noble, had many prominent Talmid Chachamim. His first cousin was Rabbeinu Yonah. Like when they got together for Hanukkah parties, you know, and the kids were off on the side, you know, they weren't watching the football game. That was Yonah and Moshe, who later became two of the greatest Rishonim. So that was a cousin of his. Suffice it to say, he was, by anyone's definition, a child prodigy. And he basically had mastered significant parts of Kabbalah, but certainly all of Shas, by the age of 16. We know that, and that's not hyperbolic or exaggerated or fanciful, because it was at 16 in which he wrote, as far as I know, his first work, which was known as the Melchamos, his Chidushim. It's organized in the back of the Gemara on a number of the Masechtos. It is really, although I'm jumping ahead to something that's really part of the second section, but the Melchamos was his defense of the Rif from the onslaught and questions of the Baal HaMor. Now, Baal HaMor wrote a very critical commentary on the Rif, and at 16, little Moshe from Gerona decided he's going to defend the honor of the Rif, and he wrote this unbelievably dense, sophisticated, complicated, intense defense. And as you guys have been learning Rambans so far this year, you know, among the Rishonim on Gemara, Ramban is one of the most important, but also one of the most difficult to read. So I would say the Melchamos is even more difficult, more complicated, more sophisticated in certain ways, certainly more intricate, often to follow, than the Chidushim al HaShas. So that was what he wrote at 16. I have to move on a little bit, okay?
Wasn't the Baal HaMor younger?
What he did? I'm not taking anything from the Baal HaMor. There's a reason they were shown him. Anyway, okay, so that's the Ramban in the early stage of his life. The good news for him is that for the next 40 plus years or so, he lived a quiet, undisturbed, fruitful, productive, happy life. He became a professional doctor. According to many, he really supported himself through medicine. Not as famous as that regard, but he was also a doctor, and according to some historical accounts that he worked at it and made his living that way. But he was also a communal rabbi, first in his local city, and then eventually in, as part of the larger Catalonia region there in Spain. He was also Rosh Yeshiva, had a famous yeshiva, many famous Talmidim, the Rajba, others. We talk about Mibet Midrasho Shel Haramban, that it wasn't just he had initial Talmidim or a few years of Talmidim, but generations of Talmidim and Talmidim's Talmidim, who all are kind of part of his sphere of influence. So this lasted until the mid-1260s. So he's already virtually 70 years old. He's in his mid to late 60s, and he's had this unbelievably successful life, scholarship, which we'll get to in a little bit, leading rabbi, doctor, the whole bit. And everything is great until 1263, when his life takes an immediate turn for challenge, and because 1263 is the date of the famous, what became known as the Disputation of Barcelona. And what happened then, very, very bekisur, because there are literally books, movies made just on this, so I'm going to give you the 3-minute or 4-minute version of it. But basically what happened in 1263, which was not unique in the sense that it happened other times in other places in Europe, but this is certainly one of the most famous of its kind. There was, as it typically went, an apostate, a Jew who had converted out to Christianity, who went by the name of Pablo Cristiani, who was able to convince the king, I think his name was King James of Aragon or something like that, he convinced the king that he could have a disputation against this famous rabbi, and he would be able to slug him up, as they didn't say in Spain, but he'd be able to disprove the Ramban and show, if he could bring down the Ramban, so then certainly that would be bad for the Jews and convince everyone to do like he did and want to convert to Christianity. So the king took this suggestion, and he summoned the Ramban to this debate. Interestingly, the Ramban already had enough clout and enough confidence to tell the king, maybe, I'll come on one condition, freedom of speech. In other words, it can't be that I'm fighting with one hand tied behind my back, that I can't say anything that's critical of the church or of the New Testament, whatever. I have to be able to say what I need to say. And the king, to his credit, as we'll see later on, also the king had much more of an open mind than some of the other people around him, the king apparently agreed to that condition. So the Ramban was free to use every argument and bit of information in his arsenal. The actual debate, I think, they say, lasted 4 days. And given that whoever this Pablo Cristiani dude was, he was like an ant or a fly on the back of somebody like the Ramban. So it's not surprising that given that the Ramban was given the freedom of speech, that he wiped the floor with him. It was by all accounts a rout. He destroyed him, and it was clear even to the king that the Ramban was winning. In fact, it was so much of a blowout that the local Jews of Barcelona, apparently at some point, mittendrinnen in the middle, begged the Ramban to kind of take it easy or stop, because they were worried that it would be such an overwhelming victory that it would lead to anti-Semitic reactions. That's, as a defense mechanism, which the more things stay the same, the more things change. This is how Jewish history goes. However, with the king's encouragement, the Ramban actually didn't stop, because the king really encouraged him to continue. And in fact, the king apparently gave him the winner's purse, which was like 300 gold coins or something like that. So it was very clear to everyone who was there that the Ramban had really done a masterful, masterful job. However, despite the clear victory, you have to understand there wasn't exactly a free press then. There wasn't exactly people tweeting out, what was happening and putting it on the, CNN.com or FoxNews.com or whatever you'd like to watch. So the only people who really knew what happened were the people who were there. So that gives good opportunity for media manipulation. Again, more things stay the same, the more things change, the more things stay the same. So sure enough, our enemies, different enemies than we have now, but in this case a similar tactic. So they libeled us, they libeled the Ramban, and they sent out throughout their sphere of influence in those parts of Europe accounts of the debate in which, in fact, the opposite happened. The Ramban got trounced, and of course the Jews were shown to be, blah, 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 blah. So the Ramban was so incensed by this that he had kept a detailed record of the whole debate, and he then published the Sefer HaVikuach. He published his account of everything that had happened, his arguments, the counter-arguments, which obviously that he won. This Pablo Cristiani guy, dude, got a hold of that, cut and pasted it, resent it out, again, in all sorts of ways, taking things out of context, taking out all the good lines of the Ramban, and again, maligning the Ramban and somehow showing that that not only had he had won, but Dafka turning the words of the Ramban in a way, We don't have time for that, okay? I'm happy to walk to lunch with anyone who has questions, but we're not going to get anything done if we have to pause. I apologize. So the bottom line was, it was making the Ramban look bad, and it really made it look as if he had blasphemed Christianity. I'm not enough of a historian to know exactly where the fine line is between him winning the debate and something even worse. But he was somehow shown to have done something, quote-unquote, even worse. And that was the excuse for the Franciscans to pressure the king to summon Ramban for a court case. He was on trial for blasphemy. So the fear that the community had that it would be taken out against them, as far as I know, didn't really, at least initially and directly, come to pass. But the Ramban's overwhelming victory did come back to haunt him. And even though the king had been the sponsor of the whole thing and had given him the winner's purse, there was, again, I'm not a historian of medieval Europe, but the relationship between the king and the church was complicated, and despite him being the king, there was still pressure on him to do what these people wanted him to do. And in fact, there was a court case, and eventually this took place over 2+ years, and in 1265 there was this trial. The Ramban convincingly argues in front of the king that not only is there a record that I didn't quote anything in that book that I didn't say in the debate, which was in front of the king. So how can you now accuse me of doing something wrong 2 years later? Moreover, the king himself had declared him the victory and had not made any objections, and the king is the one officially, being the judge. So you would think that he would have won that case very easily. And basically, even though he more or less did win, it didn't matter. Sometimes, heads I win, tails you lose. This was one of those kind of situations, despite, again, I'm not enough an expert, but it sounds like the king, in the scheme of hundreds of years of medieval Europe, this wasn't one of the really bad kings. I might be wrong, I'm not a historian, but it sounds like the king was trying to be as fair as he could, but the church and the other people had such a strong influence that basically the Ramban was condemned for blasphemy, and he somehow was either sent into exile for 2 years or he ran away. But the bottom line was, the outgrowth of this trial is basically, here is not a young man, obviously, basically meant he had to flee. And that ends that stage of his life, and that begins his trek leaving Spain, I think, if I'm not mistaken, originally a little bit in southern France, but eventually, I think in about 1267, I think the historians say, he actually fulfilled a lifelong dream and made it to Eretz Yisrael. Sometimes you can, turn the lemons into lemonade, so to speak. It was obviously a very difficult, tragic experience for him, but it did end up with him being in Eretz Yisrael. If I'm not mistaken, though, he had to leave his family behind. And I think he describes the emotional and personal pain of having to leave his family behind. But at least he himself, wasn't killed. He ended up dying of ripe old age, which we'll get to. And he ended up being in Eretz Yisrael for the last few years of his life. When he was in Eretz Yisrael, the situation was incredibly, incredibly weak. Very, very schwach. Probably as a result of the Crusades. But there were small numbers of Jews, and there were not any large communities. So they were scattered. They were small in number, they were impoverished materially and spiritually. In one of his letters, he writes that there were only 2 permanent Jewish residents in Yerushalayim at the time. That is not 200, not 20, but 2. 2 brothers, I think they were dyers or something like that. Anyway, people coming and going, but 2 permanent Jewish residents when he gets there. And basically, the Ramban begins this last stage of his unbelievably successful and influential life, by basically becoming this ultimate, amazing, amazing communal leader and revitalizing both spiritually and materially as much as he can the communities both in Yerushalayim and beyond in Eretz Yisrael, giving shiurim, rebuilding schools, yeshivas, famous shul in the old city, the Ramban shul. Obviously that exact building is not the one that he built all those years ago, but as far as I know, that's more or less the location. At least that's what they told me when I was once on a tour. And we do know that he made a shul there. We absolutely know that. The amazing thing is that basically from that efforts that he made there in those years, basically started what was, as far as I know, more or less an uninterrupted Jewish presence in Yerushalayim for about 700 years until 1948 in the War of Independence. So it went from almost nothing to it always ebbed and flowed, but he basically got it back on the map and lasted all that time. Really quite incredible. We have a number of famous letters that he wrote back to his sons and his family in Spain. And, among other things, at the ripe old age of his being in the 70s and having this traumatic experience for the end of his life, oh, by the way, that's where he found time to write the Perush al HaTorah, which is probably what he's most famous for, and unquestionably, I would say, second to Rashi, at worst, the most influential commentary on the Torah ever. So really quite an incredible person. He dies in, we know the Hebrew year, but it's something in between, something of, he was either 75 or 76, basically. It was a few years later, he dies. There are discussions about where he died. Generally, most accounts say that he's buried in Haifa, near Haifa, but there are some people who claim that he's buried in Hebron, actually, not that far from the Maris HaMachpelah, and not that long ago, some archaeologists or somebody, they found some deep, you know, cave or something, not in the Maris HaMachpelah, but not that far away from it. Some people think maybe that was what the Ramban had said. People claim he wanted to be buried near the Avos. I don't know exactly. I think popularly it's assumed, and as far as I know, but I'm not a historian or on these kind of things, that he's buried there in Haifa, died at around either 75 or 76 years old. So that is a very, very short version of some, I guess we could probably say, a life well lived. Okay? Scholarship. So 10 minutes or less on the scholarship of the Ramban. I really, if I had any integrity, I would just end the shiur now. Because how could I possibly even talk about this for 10 minutes? It's like the ultimate insult and joke. But I guess maybe 10 minutes is better than none. But just to give you a sense, a little bit of a sense of what we're dealing with. As I say, staggering in the volume of things that he wrote, staggering in the variety. And any one of the books, any one of the commentaries are so brilliant and so in-depth that they would have been a life's work in and of themselves if he hadn't written the other, I don't know, tens of others that he wrote, and if he hadn't written some of them at an incredibly young age, incredibly old age. Just everything about it is just like superhero stuff. I don't know what else to say. It's really incredible. So I'll try to divide it up into genre or different categories. Let's start with, we just came off of Morning Seder, so let's start with Gemara. So he has on most, not all, but on most Masechtos of Shas, we have the Chidushei HaRamban. Again, as you've seen, if not in high school, then certainly now, very, very difficult to learn because it's so deep and so insightful and challenging. You know, the shortcut version which we often take is to look at either the Rashba, his direct Talmud, or the Ramban, part of that Masorah, the Ritva, excuse me, because you're going to get the Torah of Man as it's distilled through the generations, but the Talmidim write a little bit easier than the Rebbe, and the Talmidim write a little bit easier than them. But you have this incredible influence of his Chidushim HaShas. Again, when you can, it certainly pays to see him as opposed to just seeing his Talmidim. Really quite incredible. Often against Tosfos, very often that ends up being a battleground, and all the other Rishonim follow him as opposed to Tosfos, and the Ashkenazi Rishonim following them. But not necessarily that way. It's not I don't mean it as a cliche, but that is often the case. In many ways, the Ramban's Chidushim, both in the Milchamos, which I mentioned already, and in the Chidushim, are kind of proto-Brisker. Again, not in a clear methodological or consistent way, the way you find later developed in Achronim, and especially in Reb Chaim Brisker, but there's a lot of conceptual distinctions that are made there, you know, much more common than just the technical things that you see in other Rishonim. If I'm not mistaken, I think I heard it from Rabbi Menachem Ginnack in YU years ago, Rabbi Ginnack, a Talmud Chacham of great distinction in his own right, but also happens to be one of the leading Talmidim of Rav Soloveitchik. So I think it was from him that I heard, and I think he might even have published this, that he felt that even though everyone associates the Briskers with the Rambam, because of all the work they did on the Rambam, but actually in terms of style and influence, that actually it was really the Ramban who was the proto-Brisker, and that might have been, to some extent, Rav Soloveitchik's favorite Rishon. That might be my quote, a formulation, not his, but there was that influence. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Ginnack, when he published his Hesped for Rav Soloveitchik, he called it walking with Ramban. And like, you do a double take, you know, when you first see that, you expected Rambam, but again, there he outlines, I think, some of the influences, again, not only in terms of the inspiration of his life, but even in terms of the methodology of his learning in Shas. As I mentioned, he did write these other Talmudic-type works that were not on the Shas per se, but were on related commentaries, and he was a huge devotee and defender of the Rif. So his first book was the Milchamos Hashem, defending the Rif from the Baal HaMor. And later, he wrote a book called the Sefer HaZechus, which is on other Masechtas, more limited, which is defending the Rif from Hasagos of the Ravid. We know the Ravid is someone who's always questioning the Rambam, but the Ravid also wrote Hasagos on some Masechtas that we have extant on the Rif. And the Ramban very much saw himself as the defender. It's not a coincidence the Ravid and the Baal HaMor are both from Provence, from southern France. They had a different way of looking at lots of things, including learning and life. So they were critics of the Rif. And the Ramban very much saw himself as a defender and a devotee, and he wrote these comments. So on some level, they're explicitly and overtly defending the Rif, but obviously they also function as Perushim HaShas in those Masechtos where the Ramban is writing those commentaries.
What was it called that he defended the Ravid?
Against the Ravid? He's always defending the Rif. He's on the Rif's team.
Against
Sefer HaZuchus. Right? Defending against the Balamor, that's called Milchamos Hashem. Defending against the Ravid is called the Sefer HaZuchus. He also wrote Sifrei Halacha. We have the most famous one that we have extant is called the Toras HaAdam. The Toras HaAdam is Halacha. It's also philosophy and Kabbalah, but it's Halacha, primarily dealing with all things relating to death. So Avelus, Kavura. He then gets into like things like Gilgul and other things that have to do with the neshama after death. But that's the Toras HaAdam, very, very famous, very influential, quoted la halacha, studied by Rabbanim, by Talmid Chachamim, on anything relating to those areas of halacha, ad hayom hazeh. Another thing that he wrote, again, would have been enough of a career in and of itself, he wrote his Hasagos on the Rambam. He was a defender of the Rif, but he was a critic of the Rambam, and in particular, he wrote a commentary in Halacha of Hasagos on the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvot. The Rambam, as we know, wasn't the first, but one of the most famous. Rav the Rishon, the catalog, the 613 mitzvos, and the Ramban wrote a running critique of the Rambam's system of counting 613 mitzvos, which in almost all standard versions of the Rambam now of Sefer HaMitzvot, if you buy it, you get the Ramban for the same price. It's become so central, you can't learn the Rambam of Sefer Mitzvos unless you're taking a look at what the Ramban wrote. We'll see when we get to the Parsha LaTorah that the Ramban was in other ways as well, not only in Halacha, but also in Parshanut and Hashkafa, a critic of the Rambam. This definitely veered with him in many ways, but it's important to note that unlike many of his time, including his first cousin, Rabbeinu Yonah, who went so far as to really wage war against the Rambam and try to ban the Rambam and other things, the Ramban never did that. In fact, he was always trying to make peace between the various factions. Even though he disagreed in many different ways with the Rambam, he was a very, very respectful and reverential disputant with the Rambam, and he never wanted to go that far at all. In fact, he was always trying to make shalom between the more extreme factions and that machlokes. So even though he had disagreements, but it was always with great, great personal respect and devotion to the Rambam. So in Halacha, that's another thing that he wrote. So that's at least four things that are just halachic and Talmudic based. Again, I say four categories because some of them have multiple volumes. But that's four different things. He also has famous drushos. There's a whole volume. There's a two-volume set published by Masada Rav Kook, which you can buy, called Kol Kisvei HaRamban, the collected writings of the Ramban. And that includes all sorts of things that most of you have probably not heard about. All sorts of drushos, Perushim on Tanakh, I don't mean the Torah, we'll get to that soon, that the Ramban wrote. And these are incredibly important philosophically, hashkafically, for Kabbalah, all sorts of different things are included in there. He has a drasha on Rosh Hashanah, drashas Tarsham Temima, he has a perush on Eov, which is very, very consequential and influential, all sorts of different things which you can find in these collected two-volume works. He also has letters. He wrote some very, very famous letters. One is colloquially known as Igeres HaRamban, which is what he wrote to his son, which is like a Musar letter to his son. Not that long, but there are people. It's so influential that many Siddurim included in the Siddur. Many people have published books as commentaries on that. There's even an art scroll version of the Igeres HaRamban with not only a translation, which is helpful for those who need it, but also a commentary by a contemporary Rav named Rabbi Foyer, who once upon a time was in Miami, then in Muncie, now in Yerushalayim. So I would recommend that, honestly. If you're looking for a one-volume Igeres HaRamban, I think there's nothing to be embarrassed about. In fact, it's a very valuable... There are other versions of it, which also have different commentaries, but the Rabbi Foyer art scroll one is, I think, excellent as well. There's another letter that was attributed to him called the Igeres HaKodesh, which is actually all about his attitude towards a number of things, particularly relating to marriage and sexuality. There was some question about if he wrote it or not. Again, I'm not an expert academic. As far as I know, it's widely considered, I don't know, call it the consensus. I think it is more widely considered now to have been written by the Ramban, even though over the decades or centuries, people have raised questions about that. And there, basically, without getting off the topic, but basically he makes the argument that, obviously within halachic parameters, that the Torah takes a very positive view of human sexuality and the physical aspects of marriage. And this was written in response to others, including perhaps the Rambam, who felt that the body and things of the flesh were more bidi eved acquiescences that the Torah made to human weakness, the Ramban looks at it in a much more positive way. Again, not unbridled, not abused, but in proper halachic holy, that's why he called it Igar Sakodesh, context of halacha, he sees it as something that is actually inherently positive. In a similar way that he speaks about in Tarha Adam, about death, not that death is inherently positive, but he speaks about human beings, in a sense, being normal. And if human beings were basically created by Hashem with a sexual urge, so clearly that must be something that's healthy, or else Hashem wouldn't have done that. So he also talks about people being sad when other people die. Well, is that really correct? After all, Hashem decided that the person should die, and if their neshama is going up to Hashem, isn't that a good thing? And the Ramban basically acknowledges, he believes in all that, but he basically says, yes, but the Torah also wants us to be normal. The Torah created us with a, please God, I don't know, a 70-year relationship or with our mother, our father, whoever, and we're sad when they die. That's actually clearly normal. That clearly must be what the Torah wants us to be. We shouldn't be kind of going against our nature as much as embracing it in the halachic context. So to me, that's kind of an indirect proof that he probably wrote, he may have written that sefer, that Eger Sakodesh, because there's a certain common approach I think you see in those two things. Last but not least is the Perush HaTorah. Again, you need a semester at least to appreciate it and a lifetime to study it, but we'll do two more minutes and then we'll finish. Basically, as I said, probably only second to Rashi in its influence, with a really different agenda. Rashi really is trying to unify the Torah Shebichsav with the Torah Shebaalpeh. You see that in like almost every Rashi. He's quoting a Midrash, your kindergarten or first grade teacher who told you that Rashi is Pshat, you know, confused you for your life. Just ask the Ibn Ezra or the Rashbam. They do not view Rashi as Pshat, at least not the way we usually define it. The Rashi is very much focusing on Torah Shebaal Peh and bringing that to the text, whereas the Ramban had a different agenda, and because he had a different agenda and different focus, he often diverges and disagrees with Rashi. His commentary is much more philosophical, Kabbalistic, focusing on the narrative, sometimes psychological, and he's really unafraid to say original things. Again, I could give multiple lectures on just like the top 10 like famous ideas in the Ramban al Torah, but the whole idea of Masa Avos Sim Labanim, you know, it's not originated but popularized by the Ramban. His whole attitude to Kedoshim Tiyu, which we mentioned before, the idea of not being a novel Bershus HaTorah, that the Torah has overarching values beyond specific mitzvos, both in Benam Lamakom, Kedoshim Tiyu, Benam Lachavero, Vashav HaTov. Again, I know I'm running, I'm sorry, but I know you have lunch now. The most dangerous thing to do is be the speaker before lunch. So anyway, a lot of very, very famous things. His whole approach to miracles, which you have in one of the drashos, but also al-HaTorah. The idea that there's not only miracles like Kriyas Yamsuf, what he calls a Nes Nigleh, but the idea of the sun rising and the sun setting, the fact that you can open up your eyes and that your kidneys or your bladder work or whatever, that's a miracle in of itself, something we all kind of take for granted. It's kind of part of popular hashkafa or kiruv or whatever literature. Well, probably the most famous articulate and first person to espouse that was the Ramban, who speaks about what he calls a Nes Nigla versus a Nes Nistar, the idea of a hidden miracle, and how there really is no such thing as nature divorced from God, it's just God working in more subtle, hidden ways. So not everyone agrees exactly with his formulation, but clearly one of the most influential ideas of the last, almost 1,000 years, and that was the Ramban there as well. So many things in the commentary al HaTorah. Important that this will conclude is that, like in halachic works, he's also very, very, he tries as many as whenever he can to be reverential to earlier authorities. He disagrees with people, sometimes like Rashi, especially Ibn Ezra and people like that, and also the Rambam and Mor Nevuchim. Mor Nevuchim has a lot of commentary on the Torah, which the Ramban did not like. He thought it was too symbolic, and frankly, probably too influenced by non-Jewish philosophy. The kind of Greco-Arabic philosophy, and that's why, again, the other people in France and Provence were very critical of the Rambam because of that. The Ramban was somewhere in the middle. He was a critic, even though he was a respectful critic, wasn't trying to ban the Rambam or anything like that, but he really was against the Rambam in many ways philosophically and in many ways in terms of his Parshanut al-HaTorah. The Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, has a small work called Halachic Mind, not Halachic Man, Halachic Mind. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's four sections. The first three are about, I think, epistemology and philosophy of science or something. If I had a whole lifetime, I couldn't understand it, and I studied philosophy as an undergrad and a graduate student. It's that complicated and it's whatever, but you're welcome to try. But what I really recommend, and it's accessible and important, is section 4. Section 4 of Halachic Mind is the Rav's approach to Hashkafa. And he talks about the Rambam versus the Ramban. And there he says that in Hashkafa, we follow the Ramban. The Rav was also a critic in certain ways of the Rambam's philosophy, especially in Mor Nevuchim, and there he talks about his preference and his belief in the Ramban. I will just end by mentioning that not only is the Ramban al-HaTorah one of the most influential works ever as a commentary on the Torah, it is also probably intended, but certainly just as a de facto, one of the most important books of philosophy that we have, of Hashkafa. I mentioned a few of the ideas. Rav Lichtenstein, among others, was a big advocate of studying Ramban ala Torah, not only as a parshan, as a commentary to Torah, but as a basis of emunah. Many of the Rav Lichtenstein's Hashkafa Shirim, which he gave either here or in the Gris Kolel in Yerushalayim for the YU Smicha guys, he gave a quote-unquote Hashkafa Shir, and many of the years, what they studied was Ramban ala Torah. Not some other book which is more quote-unquote officially philosophical, but the Ramban ala Torah. I think there's some legend about the Rav Lichtenstein saying if you were on a desert island and you can only bring two books, I think. I can't remember what the other one was. I'm guessing it's the Tanakh, but honestly, I don't even know. But definitely one of those books that you'd have in your single suitcase if you were to be on a desert island, I believe he was said was the Ramban ala Torah. And I always remember that was similar to Revolvi Zatzal in the Alei Shor. I think he writes there, I haven't seen this in many years, but I think he says basically there's four books that every Jew needs to know just to be a literate Jew. That's a scary thing because most of us don't know the four. But he says that basically, not to be a Talmud Chacham, just to be a basic Jew. There's four books you have to know. It's a big Torah, but we've been learning it for a long time. Four books. And he mentions the Ramban al HaTorah as one of those. So whether you prefer the Rav Lichtenstein's story with the desert or that Rav Olbi story, it's hard to overestimate the importance and influence of the Ramban in general, and certainly not the Ramban al HaTorah. I hope this gave you a little bit of the sense of how amazing a person and contributor he was, and hopefully it will inspire you to spend the rest of your life, because you'll need that, and then your next life after that, studying and appreciating his words. Have a good day, everybody.